Today, the latest market update. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The Dow raked up gains again on Friday, as there was a late flourish of buying pressure, which lifted the broader market to notch just a small weekly win, with energy and technology stocks leading the charge. The Dow Jones Industrial rose 1.39%, or 452 points, while the Nasdaq Composite was up 1.24% and the S&P 500 was up 1.67%. Energy stocks racked up gains as oil prices rose around 4% thanks to the ongoing Suez Crisis saga that some estimate is disrupting hundreds of thousands of barrels a day from being transported via the key shipping routes. More than 600,000 barrels a day of Middle East oil destined for the US and Europe and about 850,000 barrels of crude to Asia are transported through the Suez, according to ACM Shipbroker. While the boost to oil prices from transport disruptions will be temporary, Wall Street continues to suggest that oil prices will be heading higher as major oil-producing countries will refrain from ramping up production too quickly. We expect a slower ramp-up in OPEC plus production this spring to help offset both slower EM and EU demand recovery and higher Iranian exports, with global demand still set to increase sharply through the summer, Goldman Sachs said. Financials also participated in the broader market rally following a bid on banks after the Federal Reserve gave banks the green light to resume dividends and stock buybacks after June 30th. Cyclicals were unfazed by weaker-than-expected consumer spending in February, with economists quick to point out weather-related noise following the cold snap last month in the data, and they still reiterated the expected boost to spending from the stimulus. We'll see. We expect an additional stimulus package passed in March to raise the savings rate again, adding to a powerful tailwind of buying power that has been building among US households, ready to be deployed as the economy is reopening, Morgan Stanley said. The likely wave of consumer spending to come will boost inflationary pressures, with the latest data showing the Price Consumer Expenditure Index, the Fed's preferred measure of inflation, rising to 1.6% in February year over year from 1.4% in the prior month. Now that's, of course, still short of the Fed's 2% target, but analysts do see some further room for an acceleration in price pressures. We'll continue to see core PC inflation peaking in April and May this year, closer to 2.6%, Morgan Stanley added, but just note, of course, that isn't really much to do with real wages growth. Industrial stocks have been some of the best performers in recent weeks, even amid market weakness. These stocks are likely to get a boost from reopening optimism and President Joseph Biden's lofty infrastructure spending plans. Just take one look at the Dow Jones Industrial chart and compare it to the other major indices to gain a better understanding of why it's such a good place for investors to be at the moment. There's a good chance that this trend in industrials will continue, given that many of the companies are the backbone of the economy, which is why it might be a good time to consider adding positions to them. The United States 10-year yields topped 1.65%, though it did do little to curb investor appetite for the growth trade, with tech stocks pushing higher by a rally in chip stocks. Quick on the heels of its $1.9 trillion stimulus package, the Biden White House is now doubling down on another $3 trillion of infrastructure spending. With tax receipts going nowhere, the budget deficit is set to explode to record heights. Much of the debt issued to finance this adding spending will likely be funded by the Fed. In order to do so, they'll be forced to increase QE and that will probably occur at the same time that they announce explicit yield curve control. On the one hand, the Biden administration is clearly eager to get this next bill through Congress as fast as possible, but Republicans are likely to choke on the amount of pork barrel spending included in the bill. Hence, expect some to and fro to slow its passage. But given the Democrats' control of all levels of government, it's likely that it will be passed in one form or another in April or May at the latest. And of course, the Fed decided not to extend the SLR, the Supplementary Liquidity Ratio exemption, at the end of the month. But they did also say that they would review the SLR requirements going forward, given the need to fund the $3 trillion of new debt. To fund those stimulus packages, perhaps the Fed will loosen the constraints of the SLR in some way to facilitate the banks assisting in financing the biggest supply of new bonds the market has ever seen in such a short period of time. And then, of course, there's the Net Stable Funding Ratio, the NSFR, which is another facet of the new Basel III regulations. And, of course, these are being implemented worldwide in response to the global financial crisis of 2008 to ensure that financial institutions have sufficient high-quality assets to weather a similar crisis in the future without having to resort to bail-ins. In essence, these new regulations are designed to mitigate the risks of bankruptcies such as Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. Now, the NSFR will significantly penalise bullion banks holding gold in what's called unallocated accounts relative to fully allocated accounts. Unallocated means you have a share in a certain amount of gold, whereas allocated means you own the rights to a specific amount of gold. Unallocated gold can be leveraged, loaned out, more than once, in fact, creating multiple claims on the same pool of gold. Allocated cannot. In other words, the banks will be penalised for unallocated gold holdings and rewarded for holding the actual physical metal on an unleveraged basis. Simply put, it makes it expensive for the banks to engage in gold lending or hypothecation. Gold lending is widely considered one of the principal tools used to short gold. Eliminating or drastically reducing this activity could therefore make it difficult to short the metal and therefore could be more bullish. That's one reason why gold has been under pressure for 8 months or so in anticipation of the new regulation. Banks will clearly not want to be short of the metal. They are motivated to get out of their short positions and even go long. This is what they've been trying to do since the peak of open interest back in January 2020. Open interest has now fallen to its lowest level since May 2019, when gold hit a low of 1,269. Note that the last peak in open interest was in August 2020, and gold has been going down ever since. Banks loathe to take a loss on their short positions, so they've been waiting for lower prices to cover those positions, and they've accelerated this process since January, which is reflected in a drop in open interest since then, and are far closer to at least being neutral. Reportedly, JP Morgan is already net neutral to long. Now it's just the remaining bullion banks trying to get out of their short positions ahead of the new rules to be implemented. And some are suggesting that a rally might follow. We'll see. What we do know is that the global EFTs lost 84.7 tons around $4.6 billion, or 2% under management, in February, marking outflows for the third time in 4 months and the seventh worst historical monthly holdings loss. Global assets under management now stand at 3,681 tons, worth around $207 billion. That's levels last seen in June 2020, when the price of gold was near the February close level of $1,730. The communications sector was also a bit lower, following a slump in Discovery, Viacom and Fox Corp. And in fact, Fox Corp fell 6% after Dominion Voting System filed a $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit against Fox News Network for accusing the company of rigging the 2020 presidential election. And in other news, NeoClass cut some losses to end down less than 5% after halting production at one of its plants, citing the impact from the global chip shortage, and the Chinese electric vehicle company cut its quarter one delivery target to around 9,500 vehicles from a previous range of 20,000 to 20,500 vehicles. Now let's have a look at the international market trends. So let's look at the US stock movements over the last 24 hours. The Dow Jones was up 1.39% to 33,072. The S&P 100 was up 1.5% to 1,798. And the S&P 500 was up 1.66% to 3,974. The S&P 500 financials was up 1.7% to 572.10, whilst the Nasdaq composite was up 1.24% to 13,138. The US volatility index was down 4.8% to 1886. And Goldman Sachs was down 0.96% to 327.39. Looking at some further stocks, Google Alphabet was down 0.3% to 2024. Amazon was up 0.19% to 3052. Apple was up 0.51% to 121.21. And Facebook was up 1.54% to 283.02. Boeing was down 0.94% to 244.87, while GE was up 1.09% to 12.99. Intel was up 4.6% to 64.87, while GameStop was down 1.5% to 181. Over in the bonds, the 30-year long bond was up 0.5% to 2.379. while the 10-year was up 0.86% to 1.674. The 3-year was up 0.75% to 0.308. And the 3-month was up 1.5% to 0.020. The dollar index was up 0.21% to 92.72 and continues to move a little higher. While over in the UK, the FTSE was up 0.99% to 6,740. The Financial Services Index in the UK was up 0.44% to 804.60. And that included the Royal Bank of Scotland, NatWest, up 1.27% to 192. And Metro Bank up 2.28% to 114.55. The pound US dollar was up 0.46% to 1.3787. In Germany, the DAX was up 0.87% to 14,748, while the German 10-year bond was up 2.97% to minus 0.349, while the German 30-year bond was up 2.84% to 0.210. Deutsche Bank was up 0.96% to 10.53, and the euro US dollar was up 0.26% to 1.1796. In Italy, their 2-year bond was down 2.09% to minus 0.406. In Japan, the Nikkei was up 1.56% to 9,176. While the Shanghai Composite was up 1.63% to 3,418. The US dollar yuan was down 0.06% to 6.54. Gold futures was up 0.36% to 1,731. Silver was up 0.25% to 25.11. Copper was up 2.53% to 4.078. And crude oil, which has been all over the place, of course, partly thanks to the Suez problem, was up 3.71% to 60.73. The STOXX 600 Global Index was up 0.91% to $426.93. While the iShares Russell 2000 ETF was up 1.82% to $226.61. The S&P 500 futures was up 1.59% to $3,962. The NASDAQ futures was up 1.48% to $12,959. And looking at some of the cryptos, Ethereum was up 5.5% to $1,696, while Bitcoin was up 5.79% to $54,673. And it's worth noting that there were some significant reasons as to why it was that Bitcoin moved higher, not least the news with regard to Tesla, but also in New Zealand, they've now started talking about Bitcoin in relation to superannuation. It's worth remembering that Good Friday is next week and markets will be closed as usual. However, what will be unusual is that the closure of financial exchanges in the US and some other parts of the world comes as the government is slated to release a key report on employment in the middle of a pandemic. Why is the stock market closed while federal data is being released? That's because Good Friday this year is April 2nd. It's not a federal holiday. It's a fairly rare occurrence for the government to release a major piece of data as market participants aren't able to react to it. It's only actually happened 12 times since 1980, according to the Dow Jones market data, with the last time it occurred in 2015, and before that, it happened in 2012 and 2010. The jobs report is arguably the granddaddy of economic reports outside of GDP, but its significance has been amplified by the pandemic, particularly as market participants seek more evidence on the magnitude of the rebound a year into one of the worst public health crises in a century. The latest jobs report will come as investors are unclear about the degree to which the labour market and or the economy could fully recover or even overheat, potentially compelling the Federal Reserve to act quickly to tamp down out-of-check inflation with vaccine rollouts and some $1.9 trillion in fresh fiscal aid having helped to buttress the economy. Jerome Powell at the Fed has tried to pacify jittery markets by emphasizing that the central bank will adopt a go-slow approach to normalizing policy, which itself is forecast to be years away. National Security's chief market strategist Art Hogan told MarketWatch that it may be a good thing that the jobs report comes as the market is closed, having the weekend to digest this news and calibrate what this means for the economic expansion. That may be a good thing for the market, he said. A year ago, US non-farm payrolls fell by 663,000 in March, while the unemployment rate jumped to a 26-year high of 8.5% from 8.1%. The 2021 jobs report for March is expected to show a gain of 655,000 based on some estimates after payroll data showed that unemployment fell to 6.2% as 379,000 jobs were added in February, making the biggest such gain in 4 months. Some time to pause for financial markets may be warranted, Hogan says, because the economy still has a long way to go to achieve a healthy recovery. We still have maybe 9 million people out of the labour force. We are going to need some blockbuster levels to get to pre-pandemic levels, the analyst said, estimating that the economy would have to average some 750,000 jobs a month to achieve post-COVID levels. It could take us 2 years, so we really need to start ratcheting up those numbers, he said. Now, just touching on Bitcoin, the Kiwi Saver Growth Strategy Fund, which is part of New Zealand's national Kiwi Saver program, has reportedly invested 5% of its fund into Bitcoin. The program is meant to be used as a retirement savings vehicle for New Zealand citizens, with tax incentives and age requirements similar to the US 401k account in the US. The Kiwi Saver Growth Strategy Fund has around $244 million or $350 million New Zealand dollars in total investments, according to local news outlet Stuff. It's managed by wealth firm New Zealand Funds Management. Our Kiwi Saver is mainly built up through traditional asset classes that compound over time to give people the best retirement they can get, the fund's chief investment officer, James Grigor, told Stuff. If you are happy to invest in gold, you can't really discount Bitcoin. The announcement is a notable indicator of how Bitcoin has become de-risked as an asset in recent months, as large corporate institutions continue to divert their treasury assets to Bitcoin, and traditional financial firms look to offer Bitcoin exposure to clients, it's becoming clear that the asset has a place in, well, quite a few portfolios these days. Bitcoin's price has risen sharply as overseas institutional investors had begun buying positions for their clients in a process Grigor called the legitimization of Bitcoin. The likes of pension funds are now able to invest in Bitcoin funds like those from the United States company Galaxy Digital, in which New Zealand Funds has invested KiwiSaver money, he said. And so now to the Australian news and trends. Potential home buyers are eschewing Sydney's high property prices and investing their money elsewhere in Australia, according to a leading Sydney buying agent. The trend of rent vesting, where customers choose to continue renting the property in which they live, but buy a property elsewhere as an investment, has, he says, been on the rise as Sydney property prices continue to spiral and vacancy rates keep prices steady in the rental market. The trend that I feel has been going on for some time, but particularly in the last 6 months with my clients, is that people are now starting to be priced out of certain parts of Sydney, said Ben Plough, founder of BFP Property Buyers. So rather than being forced to live in an area that they might not necessarily want to, they're considering the rent vesting strategy. Put simply, it's live where you want to live, invest where you can afford. Take a client that has a budget of $1 million and they love the Lower North Shore or the Inner West. As ordinary as it sounds, that cash doesn't get you far towards a two-bedroom apartment in a nice block. So what I'm seeing now is clients considering using that available capital and investing in other strategic markets across the country and continuing to rent in the location that they like. Many see rent vesting strategies as a way to get their money into something for their future while maintaining the kind of lifestyle that inner city living affords. I think for a long time it's been ingrained in us that rent money is dead money, said Plough. But I think that if you look at it from a different perspective, renting a home that you live in provides you a lifestyle benefit and can be close to the amenities you want to have a meaningful life. If at the same time you're investing in alternative markets, as long as your capital is working for you, then I don't see that as a bad strategy. In some instances, it can work in your favour. There are many opportunities and locations out of Sydney that will provide you with a far superior return and better growth prospects. People, especially the younger demographic, aren't so excited about putting $1 million into an asset in Sydney. That's a lot of money, and perhaps spreading it into two or three growth assets in other markets is a better idea, he said. Rent vesting is not a new idea, of course, but it has taken off in recent months as Sydney's property prices leave the tier of consumers that might want to buy in the city unable to get into the property market where they live. It's been around for years, said Plough, but I think in the last 12 to 18 months it's become more of a trend, even more so over the last 6 months with the clients that I work with, maybe even in the last 3 months in Sydney, where the market is moving at a rapid rate, people are being priced out. I have a client who lives in a lovely part of the Lower North Shore, and 6 months ago she would have been in a position to buy a lovely two-bed apartment in that area, but now as a buyer she needs to go two or three suburbs further away, and she just doesn't want to do that. So we said she should keep renting that area that she likes, let's use her borrowing capacity and that capital and inject it into some growth assets in alternative markets that we know, based on our research and data, is going to perform quite well in the short term. I can say with a pretty high degree of confidence that we're seeing the data on the ground, tracking it and translating it into the price spheres. Well, we'll see. There are some risks to that, of course. But I do agree that renting is sometimes the better option. ASIC has revealed details of its investigation into fund managers targeting retirees with misleading claims about cash-like investments following a number of recent scandals. Appearing before the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Corporations and Financial Services on Friday, ASIC Deputy Chair Karen Chester detailed some of the regulator's recent work to identify funds targeting wholesale investors with potentially low levels of financial literacy through marketing techniques equating their products with cash. What we've been doing is monitoring the local funds management space to try and detect where we've got fund managers offering high yield for cash-like risk, as Chester said. That was what the True to Label project was about. We ran an algorithm across social media to find out how they were targeting wholesale retirees promising high yields, and that is how the Mayfair action came about. ASIC took action against the Mayfair 101 group of companies, a number of which have since been placed into liquidation in April last year over the promotion of several products to wholesale investors that the regulator said were marketed using misleading statements around their similarity to bank term deposits. Ms. Chester said that the troubled investment manager was not the only provider in the space seeking to target wealthy retirees looking for an easy return since the bottoming out of interest rates. Our MIS team is looking across the other asset classes as well. We've gone to those who were particularly targeting retirees no longer getting the returns on money in the bank, promising them higher returns but not at the commensurate risk levels that they're being exposed to, she said. The comments followed the federal court ordering the winding up of Mayfair 101 company, M101 nominees, in February after liquidators reported investors were unlikely to see a return from the $65 million raised by investors through the company. And it also follows similar losses suffered by wholesale investors from recently alleged frauds perpetrated by Melissa Caddick and Forex investment firm Castle Rock Global Capital, where administrators were recently appointed following the death of the firm's founder, David Hunter Campbell, and the disappearance of millions of dollars in investor funds. Committee member and Coalition MP Bert Manmayen asked Ms. Chester at the hearing how ASIC was currently drawing the distinction between wholesale and retail investors given the movement of much of the financial service industry towards wholesale clients as retail regulations grew increasingly burdensome. The law draws that distinction from many years ago, before we had a fully mature super system and people were retiring with balances that took them into the wholesale investor category. That's a matter of parliament, as Chester said. Traditionally, ASIC would look after retail investors because we consider they're at a higher risk of harm, but we're now in a world where wholesale investors are more susceptible to this sort of harm. We've got Google to help us out in terms of stopping algorithms that were running behind the scenes, where we see social media marketing is going to wholesale investors who we consider to be very vulnerable, like retired farmers who type in cash-like returns. This is where, going forward, we're going to have to work out what's the most effective way for us to stem that problem. Elsewhere, Big Super has signalled that it will fight the Your Future, Your Super, the YFYS reforms, tooth and nail, while taking aim at the Retirement Income Review, according to Investor Daily. The Australian Institute of Superannuation Trustees, the AIST, has called for opposition to the reforms, saying that while it supports the Morrison government's intentions, the bill is incomplete, inconsistent, unworkable, and does not achieve the policy intent articulated in the budget announcement. It's disappointing that the government completely ignored the substantial concerns raised to ensure this bill delivered on its objective, said AIST Chief Executive Eva Sherlock. This is a poorly drafted bill that will deliver more consumer harm than good if passed in its current form. Australians deserve better. Our super system is one of the best in the world, so any changes made must be evidence-based so that they improve members' outcomes rather than worsen them. The AIST warned that the legislation ignores a slew of Productivity Commission recommendations, including the underperforming products be wound up before stapling occurs, and that all super products be assessed while granting the Treasurer extraordinary powers to ban super fund investments or expenditure unilaterally. The legislation should not proceed. All these issues have not been addressed by the government. AIST submits that the Senate Economics Legislation Committee must recommend opposing the legislation in its entirety, the AIST said in its submission on the matter. Lobby groups previously displayed a grudging acceptance of the reforms that quickly turned to anger when they were tabled in Parliament almost entirely unaltered from their draft state after a month-long exposure process. Meanwhile, Industry Super Australia, the ISA, has accused the Morrison government of using souped-up modelling in the Retirement Income Review to justify cutting or freezing the legislated increase to 12%, including by assuming everybody works for 40 years uninterrupted and that their benefits are preserved until retirement. The Retirement Income Review adopted objectively wrong assumptions for their base case that vastly inflates retirement incomes. The troubling conclusion is that the review was rigged to get an outcome the government wanted, said ISA Deputy Chief Matthew Linden. Some sensitivity analysis was undertaken, which points to the problems, but this was excluded from the base case and some impacts were materially understated. Modelling based on wrong assumptions has real-life ramifications. Some wish to use the Retirement Income Review's findings to cut super for millions who otherwise wouldn't save enough for retirement. And yet, on the other hand, asset manager John Vanguard has warned the Treasury not to water down the Your Future, Your Super reforms ahead of its own entry into the market. Vanguard said that while issues around the implementation of new performance benchmarks needed deeper discussion and debate, Treasury should not risk fundamentally altering the measures announced in the benchmark by incorporating proposals from super funds. In our view, none of these alternatives are suitable as a robust, appropriate benchmarking approach, and we would strongly suggest that the government resist representations from industry stakeholders to change the originally stated benchmarking approach, Vanguard said in its submission to Treasury on the reforms. It is our strong view that a clear, objective, bright line approach is the best policy framework for the government to adopt, and that the passive reference benchmark assessment approach envisaged by the government and by the Productivity Commission before it, by the way, appropriately fits this criteria. However, Vanguard warned that the public presentation of the benchmarks, which will be visible through an ATO web portal, could be a commercial detriment to new entrants to the superannuation industry, while arguing that it would be subject to more exhaustive due diligence as a new entrant than incumbents were. From a competition policy perspective, not allowing new or recent market entrants to participate on a reasonably equal footing would be anti-competitive and in effect lock new entrants out of the large-scale superannuation market for up to the next 7 years. This is particularly so in the case of a new entrant that is operating as an RSE licensee, as envisioned by Vanguard for its own superannuation offer, Vanguard said. Vanguard also said that while it agreed with the controversial decision to exclude administration fees from the performance benchmarks, the success of the reforms would depend on the degree of consumer comprehension and engagement with the ATO portal. At a minimum, an accurate depiction of an individual's fund's overall costs, net of both investment and non-investment components, will be critical to consumers' understanding and confidence in this new public-facing tool, Vanguard said. Vanguard was previously signalling its intention to enter Australian superannuation market with a low-cost product aimed at stealing market share away from the sector's largest players. This is an ambitious plan and it requires us to focus our long-term efforts on opportunities that enable us to serve better direct investors, a spokesman for Vanguard told Investor Daily last year. We've built significant expertise in this space and we think our focus on high-quality retirement strategies coupled with our disciplined low-cost approach to investing could potentially help more Australians reach their retirement goals. The Morrison government has yet to commit to a course of action on those legislated areas. So it's worth noting, of course, that this whole superannuation area is highly contested. And I've said for some time that superannuation as currently structured is not doing Australians well at all. I worry that the government's fiddling around the edges rather than dealing with some of the substantive structural reform that is required. So let's look at the local market movements. The ASX 200 was up 0.49% to 6,824. The ASX Financials was up 0.4% to 6,072. And the Real Estate Trusts was up 0.13% to 1,426. The Volatility Index was up 9.78% to 1,252. While the ASX 200 futures was up 1.08% to 6,848. Amongst the banks, ANZ was up 0.97% to 28.17. CBA was down 0.62% to $86 dead. NAB was up 0.77% to 26.17. And Westpac, who announced further branch closures, was up 0.91% to 24.34. Bank of Queensland was up 1.64% to 8.70. Bendigo Adelaide Bank was up 2.18% to 9.86. And Suncorp was up 0.2% to 9.92. Macquarie was up 0.41% to 153.40. And AMP was up 0.75% to 1.345, following further concerns about the CEO's future. Genworth was up 3.92% to 2.65. McGrath was flat at 65 cents. And Yellow Brick Road was down 3.23% to 9 cents. AFG was down 1.54% to 2.56. And Mortgage Choice was up 0.43% to 1.175. Afterpay Touch was up 0.41% to 105.89, while Cymec was up 1.24% to 17.98. The Aussie dollar was up 0.74% to 76.35, and the euro Aussie dollar was down 0.48% to 1.5446. Two-year bond was down 9.41% to 0.077, and the target three-year bond was down 11.79% to 0.093, with, of course, further central bank intervention. The 10-year bond, though, was up 3.36% to 1.723, and the gold Aussie cross was down 0.45% to 2,268. And the Bitcoin Aussie Cross was up 5.27% to 72,052. And just before I go, a quick reminder that on Tuesday, we'll be spending time with a Brisbane property buyer discussing that local property market. And you'll be able to ask a question live. So mark your diary and join us at 8 p.m. Sydney time on Tuesday.